Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
This episode is brought to you by Escape Makers' first-of-its-kind virtual agritourism conference. For more information, go to escapemaker.biz. That's escapemaker.biz.
Meat and Three is back! We're kicking off our fourth season and celebrating HRN's 10th anniversary with a very special episode about our home, Brooklyn.
Roberta's was such an interesting place with such a strong gravitational pull. It attracted all these different groups.
The neighborhood has changed a lot over the past decade, from its culinary renaissance to the complicated implications of gentrification.
I would say the majority of the people who are members of our co-op definitely have a certain purchasing power, are mostly white, and we are trying to change that.
We're taking you on a journey that spans the birthplace of food radio to buzzy neighborhood pollinators to the transformative health journey of our borough president.
That was my moment of, you know, wow, someone has thrown me a life raft and I'm going to take it.
Subscribe to Meat and Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. And today we're talking about school food, people. I have with me right here in my very own living room, Margaret Reed, a food policy consultant who works with nonprofits and school districts on a variety of food system topics, such as school meals, farm-to-school programs, and food insecurity. And in addition to consulting, Margaret is the committee chair of the Rhode Island Food Policy Council. She sits on the Advisory Council for Farm to Institution New England and on the Policy Committee for Slow Food USA. She has an MA in clinical psychology from Northern Arizona University and a BS in health and exercise science from Centenary College of Louisiana. Thank you for joining me today. Wait a minute. What's the health and exercise? How did you get to be a food policy consultant with a health and exercise degree?
That's a really good question. I just kind of morphed along the way, I guess you could say. Food became an interest of mine later in life.
Uh-huh. Well, you look very young, so it couldn't have been too late. Couldn't have been too late in your life. I mean, I'm not going to make a guess here, but I know you're less than half my age. Let's put it that way. So the news was full, and this was the national news. This was on ABC, CBS, NBC, and lots of other channels, both on television, on radio, and on in print medium. And the story was the following, that the yogurt maker, this was a brilliant public relations move on Chobani's part, I must say. The yogurt maker Chobani, which has a good history of being a do-gooder type of company anyway, they got national news coverage because they paid off a $77,000 debt in the Warwick School District for unpaid lunch money. So, Margaret, what happened here? Why was there $77,000 in arrears in a, you know, probably not very expensive food program?
Like, yeah.
Isn't school lunch about $1.60 or something?
A little bit higher than that. But something I want to first point out is So that district, as you said, has made a lot of recent national news. It's not the only one. Actually, this has been a hot topic among school districts for the last couple of years.
Oh, no kidding.
So the kind of the media coverage, somehow one particular school district gets a lot of attention in the media. It dies down. Months later, another one comes into play. So so while right now we're talking, you know, people are hearing about it, this is one of many that for the last few years that has been in the media.
Uh-huh. For this same reason.
Yes.
So what happens is that kids who are, this is not the kids who are low-income kids who can't pay because they generally qualify for free or reduced lunch, right?
So it,
these are the kids who can pay.
So there is a very small percentage of the what we call free kids. So first, let me clarify. A child will fall into one of three categories for school lunch or school meals. And so what we use is the term of free, reduced price, or full price, full paid. And so free, and that is all determined by the family's income. So depending upon that is where they will fall. So as the name implies, free lunch that kids, you know, they do not pay. Kids do not pay. The families do not pay. So they'll get free lunch. And if the school's offering breakfast, they'll get free breakfast as well.
Right.
The reduced kids, so it's a little bit higher income, but not as high as the full price. They're paying a reduced price than what, you know, the full price kids are paying. Same thing for breakfast as well. So for those school meals. So in terms of this unpaid meal debt, there could be some kids that qualify for free meals, but because of a few different reasons, they might have an account balance that's in the negative. However, this is more common among the reduced and the full pay price.
Sure.
So for another variety of reasons. But I guess I should first clarify is like, well, how could a kid that qualifies for free lunch, how is their account, in the negative?
Yeah, good question.
So
I'm glad you thought of that.
So in that case, the child's family has maybe not have applied, filled out the application in the beginning of the school year.
Right. I remember having to fill that out.
Yep. So that is what fully determines, you know, the price point for each of the families, but then also will be part of the makeup for the whole school and the whole district when people talk about percentages. So, you know, high poverty, they're going to have predominantly all free kids. Well, not free kids, but.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Free lunch for most of the students.
Yes.
Yeah, got it.
So, but in your cases where it's a lot more mixed within the school or mixed within the school district, they're more than likely, it's very common to not get all of your applications completed, you know, at 100%.
Right.
And so because they don't have that documentation, they're not able to get reimbursed by federal and state government. So therefore, that's how that particular account will get into the negative.
I see. So it's not that the kids are not necessarily, well, it is that the kids are not necessarily paying, but there are a variety of reasons for why they're not showing up with the cash.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And then I read something, I read a whole bunch of articles about this, and apparently there's like even a card where you can just kind of like charge things up to mom and dad if you, if you have that and you're one of those kids that are expected to pay something.
Yes.
So there's that problem as well, right?
Yes. And so I think for listeners, I'll kind of walk them through a cafeteria experience because, when we talk about pay, this isn't necessarily meaning, you know, mom or dad is giving their kids, cash every day to pay.
It's not like you had your 15 cents milk money like I had when I was going to school.
Exactly.
Like you literally did give 15 cents a day for milk money.
Exactly.
Doesn't happen anymore.
No. So now it's all, nearly all districts across the country are digital. So, you know, as a child enters the cafeteria, you know, they'll have options of different lunch lines to go through. So usually there's at least two lunch lines in every cafeteria. One is that so they can get more kids through the lunch lines faster.
Right.
And then also some of it is because they have more options for kids. So, you know, there might be a hot lunch option. There might be a cold sandwich option. So, again, to get kids through quicker, but also because some, you know, in some cafeterias, kids can have a lot of different choices for, what lunch they would like that day.
Uh-huh.
So they'll go through the lunch line at the end. It's called a POS system. So, you know, point of sale. So usually what happens is they enter in their ID. So they punch it into a little keypad.
Yeah.
And then they go on their way. And that is how the school and how within the school district, that's how they do their claims. So, you know, we served X amount of meals this day. So they report that back to the government. And that's how they're able to get back the appropriate amount of money.
They get their reimbursements from data.
Yeah. Exactly. So when we talk about all these prices, we're talking about the reimbursable meal. And reimbursable because, you know, the school district will get reimbursed. And of course, there's a whole bunch of nutrition standards, you know, in terms of what constitutes a reimbursable meal. And so, you know, kids have to take a certain amount of different food items. So if you were to just go through the line and get a milk, that's not a reimbursable meal.
Or just dessert.
Exactly. Although you're not, you rarely see a dessert nowadays.
Oh, is that right?
Yes. Now. Yeah.
Jell-O is over.
Oh, probably. I haven't seen that in a while. Maybe not. I don't want to, you know, I haven't been in all school districts. But another thing to keep in mind, too, is so there's the reimbursable meal. But at lunchtime, in all high schools and in some middle schools, they offer a la carte. So in part of, you know, recent nutrition standards improvement, a la carte is the items that are within the a la carte is what's called smart snacks. And so it's a great name if, you know, just in terms of kind of naming a program. However, these are items that can't be sold in the lunch. And these are just additional side options for kids to be able to get more food. Now, none of that is reimbursed. So as they take, you know, it might be within the lunch line as they're going through, or it might be at a different area of the cafeteria to get, you know, so sometimes it might be in vending machines, or it might be, you know, a little snack store or something like that. And so those are items with its separate, you know, nutrition standards from the school meal. And the reason why I say it's a great name, but if you were to kind of look at some of the products, you would, so for example, whole grain Pop-Tarts, you know.
Yeah.
You wouldn't necessarily call that a smart snack.
I was not, I wasn't thinking it was going to be like, you know, edamame beans or, you know, something like that.
It could be though.
It could be, but that's just not happening now.
Yeah.
One hopes that it will eventually someday.
Exactly. There's always room for improvement. And of course, it's not to say that all of the products are bad, but those are also additional things that a student can purchase and would get charged to their account.
And would that be something that a school district might make money on?
Yes.
Okay.
So usually the number one reason why they will do a la carte is because they make more money from those products than they do from breakfast and lunch.
Right.
So
because those are reimbursed at the federal level.
Yep.
So let's talk about the federal level, actually. How much money does the USDA allocate per, you know, I don't expect you to know exactly the, but I'm sure it varies state to state. But,
yes. $2 to $3 is
$2 to $3.
Yes.
And I remember like a while back when I was first started getting interested in school food, and my colleague Laura Stanley at Heritage Radio was doing a program called Inside School Food. And the reimbursement at that time was, I forget what it was, $2 and something, but only 92 cents of that was actually for food. And the rest of it was admin costs and labor. And I'm just curious, when the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act happened and they started changing some of those nutritional standards, did that allocation change?
No, unfortunately.
It
would have been. So that's another thing to point out in regards to the complexities of a school meals and also just how hard of a job it is for food service directors, cafeteria staff, you know, food service management companies. They are dealing with very little money that has to stretch very, very far.
Right.
So if, you know, you're already thinking you're going to get $2 to $3 somewhat, you know, of course, like you said, it varies by state. You know, that already is a like, wow, like think of how many meals can you and I like immediately create off of that amount. But then
rice and beans.
And then to think that all in addition to food cost that has to pay for labor, that has to pay for administration, that's got to pay for overhead. You know, some in some school districts, you know, that's paying for janitorial service as well, too. So it's got to stretch very far. There are some states, very few, but might do give an additional reimbursement. So maybe like 10 cents per meal, for example. And it's usually tied to stronger nutrition standards, or maybe they might do if they purchase more local food, which of course is more than likely going to be more expensive.
Right.
But it helps to kind of offset that. So of course, school meal programs are nonprofits. They're not meant to be, you know, for profit. But to me, school programs that don't go into the negative is absolutely amazing. So it's definitely one of those, fights that hopefully, you have to, something you always have to work on, in terms of, how can we get more, funding to, for these programs.
It is astonishing to me that the old white men in Congress, do not see the wisdom of providing nutritious meals for children. And the Republican position ever since Healthy Hunger Free Kids was enacted has been, they don't eat it, they waste it, they're throwing it out, blah, blah, blah. But there was a recent study, and I can't remember, of course, who conducted this study because I'm, borderline senile now. But there was a study that showed that food waste, which of course we don't want in any case, but food waste before Healthy Hunger Free Kids and better nutrition standards was actually exactly the same as it is now. In other words, it's not like they're throwing out more apples. They're not throwing out more whole grains.
Yep.
It's the same. It's a wash.
Yep.
So
that's funny because that's one of my studies that I did in my previous job. Yeah. Yeah. So I know a lot. Unfortunately, I know a lot about plate waste. I say unfortunately because it's not this, glamorous, topic.
Food waste is a very sexy topic.
True.
Absolutely.
True. But yes, that is something that is the anecdotal, stories do not match what's really happening.
Yeah.
And so food waste is not as large of a problem. I mean, of course, any food waste is bad.
Sure.
But people think that there's a lot more going into the garbage and a lot more that's not getting eaten than what is really is.
Uh-huh.
And of course, no, that's something else that we need to work on in terms of getting kids to consume, more of what's on their tray.
Yeah.
But yes, in terms of like the fight for stronger nutrition standards, the fight just to even keep the standards, that is great data that we have now to show that we can refute that.
Right. Thank God. I'm so done with the old white Republicans. I'm just so over them. So I want to talk about CEP.
Yes.
Because in this Chobani, mm-hmm. kerfuffle in which, the school district ran into the red, and there was a lot of sort of throwing around of various acronyms, and CEP was one that I saw a lot.
Yep.
So what is that? What is that kind of funding?
So CEP stands for Community Eligibility Provision.
Mm-hmm.
So what this program does is for school districts that reach a certain threshold of, of free kids, then they automatically, of course they have to apply for CEP, but if they have that, if they're able to show that they have that threshold, I want to say it's 70%, but I could be wrong because my memory's a little fuzzy on the numbers, but it's a certain threshold. If the school district meets that, then they can be CEP, meaning that all kids, it's 100% free.
Uh-huh.
So there's no reduced price. There's no full paid.
Right.
So that is one of the solutions in terms of when we talk about unpaid meal balances, that's one of the solutions for future is in terms of there are a lot of school districts out there across the country that do qualify for CEP, but they have not implemented it for a variety of reasons.
Uh-huh.
One of the nuances to CEP, and of course, it's great for, in terms of prevention for unpaid meal balances, but it has so many other benefits. One being that parents wouldn't have to fill out those applications every year.
Right.
So less paperwork for parents, but also less paperwork for
the school district.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But also something to kind of keep in mind is within a school district, especially school districts that have a lot of schools, so like 40, for example.
Uh-huh.
So each, and of course at each of those schools, it's a different makeup of students.
Right.
So some of those schools are going to vary by students who qualify for free, reduced, and full. So sometimes you can have within a school district certain schools that qualify for CEP, but some schools that are, they're close, but not enough.
Right.
So in that case, the whole district can't have CEP, but those particular school buildings could.
I see. Huh. It sounds complicated, incredibly complicated.
Yeah.
So just out of curiosity, how many kids, like in a, say, an average school of, I don't know, what's an average size, 500?
That's an easy number, but yeah.
Okay. What's the percentage of kids who are actually taking part in school lunch? Because in my, when my daughter was growing up, she literally would not touch it from kindergarten on. She never participated in school lunch. And I know that there's, some people say there's a stigma involved in being one of the kids that maybe there's a social aspect to it. But the reality for her was that she just thought the food was disgusting and she wouldn't eat it.
Yep.
So she brown bagged all the way through. So, and I think there's probably enough kids who do that.
Yep.
What is, you know, first of all, what are, how many kids are participating? Is there a stigma associated with consuming school lunch? And lastly, if enough kids opt out, what is the impact on the school program?
Yeah, yeah, great questions. So in terms of what we would call as participation rates, so that, of course, like all things, will, again, vary by schools.
Yeah.
And, of course, vary by school districts. So when you think of your school districts that are have a higher percentage of free students, those are everyone gets free breakfast, everyone gets free lunch. So the stigma's gone because everyone's the same. Everyone is treated the same.
Right.
So, which is fabulous. And also, it's your participation rates are going to be high because of that.
So then you get a big reimbursement at the end of the year.
Exactly. Okay. So the more kids you have participating, you know, the more kids that are buying the meals, the greater it is because, you know, more money. So right. You have more money to do more things with. Now, when you get into schools with, you know, a mixed percentage of free, reduced price, or even reduced and full price, now you're moving into, of course, you know, all students are customers.
Right.
But now you're now you have a different type of customer. So these are kids that, like you said, you know, they might be brown bagging it, you know, for a variety of reasons.
Sure.
So your participation rates are going to be dropping down. So those are, you know, the role of a food service director in those types of schools is you are working a lot harder to get your participation rates up, you know, for your different programs.
Right.
So, you know, one, sometimes it's just more of the culture of like, of, you know, mom or dad in the morning is packing the lunch and that's just how it is, you know. It's just more common. It's, you know, it's kind of the culture. Sometimes they might participate on some days and other days they don't. So, you know, right. You have mixed in terms of,
I was always
like,
trying to get her to do it so I didn't have to pack the damn lunch.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Think of something every day. I mean, and it was expensive.
Yes. And another thing too, to keep in mind is, you know, again, just speaking from like a research perspective, is that we know that the school lunch is healthier than packed, than, you know, brown bagging. So that, of course, that doesn't mean that every parent out there that does do a brown bag is packing a unhealthy lunch. But that's also more of why we try to drive kids and parents to participate in those programs.
Yeah, so, because there's a whole, in the grocery aisle, there's an entire aisle or, you know, section of the refrigerated case of very unhealthy products,
yep.
Lunchables with like processed meats and cheeses.
Yes.
There's like, it's fatty, it's too much salt. I mean, I look at that stuff. I didn't pack that for Delilah. She,
yep.
She wouldn't eat that either.
Yes.
But it's a challenge to pack a lunch, which I get.
Yep.
And it's a challenge to make something that isn't already made for you. It's very tempting to want to use that.
Yep.
So yeah, I can see how what kids are bringing in of their own. There's like mom's throwing in a bag of chips, a couple of Lunchables, a cookie, and Bob's your uncle, you know?
Exactly. Or you can also pack that lunch, but they're buying items. So maybe they're buying just milk or they're buying stuff from Smart Snacks that's getting charged the account. So, you know, they're even mixed in terms of like, you know, every day I bring my brown bag, but I might be buying an item or two, you know, from the schools, so.
Yeah, right. Okay, let's take a break here.
This episode is brought to you by Escape Maker's first-of-its-kind virtual agritourism conference. Did you know that every $1 invested in tourism marketing returns on average $3 to $8 back? Not a bad ROI. Learn how to grow your agritourism business via 12 workshops entirely women-led. The local travel landscape is rapidly changing to meet the demands of the leisure, event, and corporate travel sectors. Whether you're a farmer or producer, a winemaker, a restaurateur, or a destination marketing organization, there's more opportunity than ever to capture these markets. The Virtual Agritourism Conference will provide you with insights and skills to keep your target demographic coming back for more. 14 speakers providing 6+ hours of education that you can watch at your convenience anytime on any device. maximize your time, budget, and resources, and focus on creative solutions to help your business thrive. Presented by Escape Maker and Fulton Stahl Market, the full conference access pass is now available for purchase. Use the code HERITAGE2019 for $50 off a full pass at checkout. For more information and to purchase your pass, go to escapemaker.biz. That's escapemaker.biz.
I hope you're enjoying this podcast. And you know, Heritage Radio Network has thousands more. Hi, my name is Linda Palacio, and I'm the host on A Taste of the Past here on HRN. Join us on a weekly journey through culinary history, where we explore the when, where, what, and why of food throughout history. You can find A Taste of the Past wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
And we're back. This is Margaret Reed, a food policy consultant who's talking to me about school food today. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights, which you already know because you're listening to a podcast after the fact. But anyway, I just thought I would remind you of that. So, Margaret, we were talking about participation and the fact that the kids who opt out, that has a negative impact on the reimbursement for the school lunch program. And then it made me think when we were talking earlier about like better nutritional standards and stuff like that, that there doesn't seem to be an incentive program for schools to ramp up. Like if the government decided that they wanted to see better school lunches, imagine that.
Yeah.
Okay. Imagine if we had that. Wouldn't it make sense? I mean, it seems to me that you could probably make that stretch that dollar further if you had more participation and still provide better quality food, including sourcing from local purveyors. And I'm wondering why there can't be some kind of an incentive program. This is just, I'm just making this up, but an incentive program for schools to participate in, should they have the infrastructure, should they have the local availability, you know, there's a whole raft of things that have to be in place to make that work. But would that be legislation? Would that be like a local school board would make that decision? I mean, how if a parent organization wanted to get their school to have better food, like what are their options?
Yeah, I mean, there is, of course, I mean, the very hardest battle would be trying to get the federal government to provide more funding.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's your hardest one. Now, states can, you know, or school districts with, you know, can work for their state to try to find some, you know, more funding. So, like I said earlier, you know, instead of different types of programs. So, you know, you get extra cents per meal for the local food or if you're offering even healthier standards, of course, trying to create that type of legislation, you know, you'd have to find the money and where that money would come from. Right. But yes, that would be through legislation. Because it's also, I mean, because it'll be sustainable versus just trying to, you know, get donations or fundraising. I mean,
Pish tush.
Exactly.
That ain't never going to happen.
Yeah. So these are, with these school meals programs, your solutions are always through policy.
Yeah. Right. And you mentioned that some states are able or districts are able to offer a free lunch to all. So how is that possible if it's, I mean, given what we've just been discussing, how can any school district have enough money to be able to do that?
Well, I mean, because, you know, they're getting reimbursement.
Because they have 100% participation rate.
Very close to 100. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No one ever has 100% just because, you know. Attendance is not 100%, you know,
gotcha.
And whatnot.
Right.
But you know, you always, you're in those types of school districts, you're going to be very close to 100%.
Uh-huh. And that's really the only way you can move the needle is to really. So that's where being a food director in a school program requires an unbelievable amount of ingenuity.
Yes.
And imagination.
Yep. To get those numbers
to
up.
To get the numbers up and then be
and
able
then,
to sort of
and then keep the
piggyback,
numbers up. Yep.
Piggyback better food onto that.
Yes.
Oh my God! I'm so glad I don't work in that
field. It's they have thankless jobs.
Yeah,
and
really.
I mean, and they play a huge part in the lives of our kids and you know the future generations. So I mean, it's certainly a job I would never want, but a job that I highly respect, and we don't thank them enough for the work that they do.
I couldn't agree with you more. Well, I mean, I think schools, teachers, people who work in the school system overall are grossly underappreciated on a national level.
Yep.
But That being said, I think we all know that. Now, what do you describe that sort of the tiers of funding, determining the federal contributions, and then how they bill the parents and all of these complicated systems that are in play?
Yeah.
What does that cost? Because it seems to me that if you eliminated all of these administrative tasks involved in tracking who gets what and how much they pay and the smart snack, like dividing all that up, like, isn't that really, really expensive to do that?
And takes a lot of time as well, too. Yeah.
And it's inefficient.
And takes a lot of technology as well, too, you know? Free Lunch for All is, you know, there's people out there that have that vision and are fighting strong for it, like Alice Waters, for example. That's one of her dreams.
Or Ann Cooper, Chef Ann. That's a big...
Exactly.
Push for her from her. Yeah,
exactly. So, I'm totally on board with that vision. I know that would, maybe in my lifetime, I might see it. That's another example of that would be a benefit for it. The administrative cost would go down because, that's less paperwork. That's less calculations you have to do. That's less like money chasing you're having to do. Back when we were saying how much, those dollars have to stretch, paying for the software and the POS system, like all of that, that's part of how that all gets paid for.
Yeah, very interesting. It also makes me think of my daughter attended UMass in Amherst for several years, and the food director there is a wonderful man named Ken Toong. And Ken has kind of revolutionized college dining. You've probably heard about him.
Yeah.
And he's done a number of things that have, had an impact on food waste, which is to not allow kids, they don't give trays, for example.
Yeah.
So children can only take a dish as they want. There's no loading up your tray with like 10 things and then a bite of each. And
yes.
So that was such a simple fix for that. But it also, I could talk on endlessly about Ken's work, but the thing that really makes it interesting to me, and which I wonder could be translated into school districts, is to that program, his dining program, is so popular. It's a tremendous selling point to students and parents. One reason why I thought it was great is that it exposes kids who might not otherwise have had experience of nice food, which is often very true.
Yep.
If you have two parents working and
you're
probably eating a lot of prepared foods, fast food, stuff like that. So this was a way to introduce children to healthy, nutritious, attractive, and interesting foods.
Yeah.
And you pay through the nose for this program. I will say that.
Yeah.
But I thought, it was such a smart investment in education of both palates and also a sense of what is nutritious. What is nutrition all about? How do I care for myself? And college is meant to prepare you for living on your own.
Yep.
And that is one thing. Like even though I'm a cook, so my daughter grew up with great food.
Yep.
But that has informed her experience at college, informed the way she eats now.
Yeah.
As a young adult. And she actually eats way better than I do. I mean, she's much more health conscious than I am.
Yeah.
Doesn't cook all that much, but she eats a ton of vegetables and grains and not that very much. I mean, like she absorbed the lessons from this program. So this is a long-winded way of asking you whether school districts could employ almost a similar sort of philosophy towards their lunch program that would draw people to that particular school or that district.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if that's an experience that you are seeing out in the field.
There's a few few school districts. I can't think of which cities off the top of my head, but that have they've totally revolutionized.
Well, like Denver with Chef Ann.
Exactly.
Is one of them. Yeah.
Exactly. That have totally revolutionized the quality of the food and the meals, but also the culture within the cafeteria as well, too. So, the cafeteria should be a place that it's inviting, that is a place where you want to go and have and eat. And so, you know, there's a lot of people that like try to envision the cafeteria as, you know, something like learning labs, you know.
Right.
So it's not just about eating. This is where they're learning about nutrition. This is where they're learning what constitutes a meal. This is where they're getting exposed to different types of foods and, you know, nutrition education and all of those types of things. So that is a is something that, you know, the cafeteria and the school meals program should be striving to become, for sure.
But isn't one of the biggest drawbacks to that idea, and I, you know, I'm not trying to catch you up, but like when Delilah was in school, I'm sorry to keep referring to my own child, but that's my experience yes. of public school system.
Yeah.
When she was in kindergarten and first grade, she ate lunch at like 10:45.
Yeah.
And of course, you don't want to eat lunch at 10, you know, it's like nobody's ready for lunch at 10:45. And that was one issue
yep.
that I heard that I've read about in terms of like trying to improve participation and so
yes.
forth and eliminate food waste. But the other thing is there's so little time
yep.
for them to eat.
Yes.
It's like 20 minutes. What's
yes.
the average lunch break, do you
so
think?
So it should be at least 20 minutes of, you know, seat time. So sitting down and being able to eat their meal. That's of course not the reality of the situation, because you know this is you know, not just school meals, but all subjects are trying to, you know, you're trying to cram in as much as possible within the school day.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, not that much time is allotted for breakfast and for lunch. And, you know, in some countries they offer a whole hour, which is awesome, you know, but, you know, that is a shorter mealtime. Plus if you're in a very chaotic environment, and of course too, like some meals require, take more time to eat, you know, peeling an orange, you know,
sure.
And of course, you know, thinking of younger kids compared to high school students, you know, things like that. But also, you know, if we give them more time to eat, you know, one, it could also make it less chaotic. It could be a more enjoyable place, but of course, yeah, they'll have more time to eat, so that there will be less food waste and they are consuming more.
Yeah.
And then of course there, you know, another issue is sometimes there is very early, lunch meal times. So like you said, 10:45, you know, that's not a typical time that we consider it would be lunch, you know,
definitely not.
And so I sympathize with, you know, those, you know, the people who are trying to schedule the full day and making sure they're getting all those students. But I do say, I do give the caveat that maybe 10:45, you know, this is of course not common, but 10:45 may not necessarily be a bad time, because we have to look at the full picture. So you got to look at, well, what time did they have breakfast? You know, did they have breakfast at 7 a.m.? So
right.
10:45, you know.
4 hours later.
Exactly.
You can be ready to eat.
Exactly. And if your school is getting out at 2, you know, your snack is after, you know, that sort of thing. So you really, what you have to do is you have to look at what time do they wake up, get on the bus? How long are they on the bus? Are they on the bus for a whole hour, you know, getting to school? What time does the school start? Then, you know, sometimes there's snack between breakfast and lunch, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So these are types of things that you have to consider with time, but you also have to consider too with consumption, you know, as well too, of like looking at the bigger picture.
Right, right. Now, I'm just going to keep you for a few more minutes, because I think we're kind of running out of time here, and I'm also worried that my battery is going to die.
that would not be good.
That would not be cool. what was the question I was going to ask you? What are there any schools? I mean, we talked about Chef Anne and Denver. I mean, but is there a blueprint that you could point to that would like be kind of like the fix or a fix, one of several fixes?
Yeah, yeah. There's certainly not exactly a one size fits all. You know, first and foremost, the biggest solution is more funding, you know,
yeah.
for people to have to buy better quality foods, you know, to pay their staff more, that sort of thing. So funding would help solve a lot of different things.
Right.
But there's no one size like that blueprint. It all kind of varies because, you know, it's the diversity makeup of the student population. You know, it is what does that, you know, particular community care more about? You know, some are more concerned about local versus others are not.
Sure.
So, you know, they're going to work on getting increasing their procurement of local products before something else. So so that's kind of why, you know, they, you know, each school district works on different things because of, you know, community needs.
Sure. That I understand that. Why? This would be my last question. Why do you think that the taxpayer why do you think that school meals are so low on the priority list for most of the population. I mean, let's face it. Like, people think, you know, if they think about school food at all, it's like, oh, it's so gross. I remember when I was a kid, it was elephant ears and, you know, shit on a shingle and blah, 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 you know.
Yes.
And, but there's no sense of like, oh, well, you know, like, we should really change that because it sucks.
Yeah.
You know? Why are we so apathetic about this?
Well, one, I think there is just the history of the program. I think it's also just the history of institutional food. That doesn't sound exciting. Then I think there's also the, like, people don't realize there are some great programs out there. There are some awesome districts. There's some awesome food service directors. So when we talk, you know, when you get the normal reaction of, ooh, gross. You know, that's not across the board, you know, and we don't talk enough about those stellar school districts, or we don't talk about, you know, particular, like, oh, I love this meal that they do, you know, that's not hyped up enough, unfortunately. So, I think that is definitely something we need to be talking more about instead of, you know, ooh, gross, gross, gross. Tell me something that's great, you know?
Yeah.
Because that's also something, or even just when people say, ooh, gross, it's amazing when I've heard teachers complain or, you know, administration. And then I say, you know, oh, that's disgusting. And I'm like, well, have you tried it? No, I haven't. You know, so like those are.
So even the people who work in the school system are not really thinking of this as a problem that they can solve.
Yeah. I mean, well, how often do your superintendents, your principals, your teachers, how often are they buying the meal for themselves and even just having the meal, you know, sitting at the table and eating with students, you know?
Right. So not so often.
Yeah.
I feel like this is an area where we could do, if we could focus on this collectively as a society, the way they have in other countries.
Yep.
You know, we could probably improve. I mean, I'm not saying we got to be serving these kids gourmet meals.
Yes.
You know, nobody's going off the deep end with this, you know.
Exactly. I mean, it starts also, too, because, I mean, we don't prioritize education.
Yes.
So if we're not prioritizing education and school meals is a part of that day, you know, it's
and a critical part of that day, because as study after study has shown, don't learn if you're hungry.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, yeah, food and education, food and health, it's so intertwined.
Yeah.
That, you know, when we're, you know, when we focus on school meals, we'll actually be working on other issues as well, too.
Right. Right. Well, Margaret, thank you so much. This has been a wonderful discussion. I think we're going to have to do it again.
Well, I'd be happy to come back. And thank you
really
so much
it.
For that.
You're very welcome. Thanks to my sponsor and to Matt. And see you next week with another show. Thanks for listening, folks.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebrations happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends. And please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.